first of all, since there hasn't been a lieutenant governor for the past 2 years, how would you make that role more consequential?
Very good question. There were 2 years left on the lieutenant governor's term when Attorney General Matt Dinn became Attorney General and vacated the position. So the state constitution states that the governor did not have to appoint when there's 2 years left on the term. So I wanted to make sure people have an understanding of the dynamics of why there was not a lieutenant governor. As a result of not having a lieutenant governor, the lieutenant governor presides over the Senate. The lieutenant governor, should something happen to the governor, becomes governor. And the lieutenant governor also is the chair of the Board of Pardons. Now, that last job that I just mentioned is crucial because there's such a backlog now with people trying to get pardons as a result of not having a lieutenant governor. So I think it's imperative that this state does have a lieutenant governor, not just because I'm seeking the seat, but the person who chairs the Board of Pardons, that person can ultimately be the tiebreaker. And I'm aware of a situation where it was a 2-2 situation where it was two yeses and two noes. So that individual now has to come back before the Board of Pardons. So in cases where people are really, they've made a mistake in life. Who hasn't made a mistake in life? But as lieutenant governor, I get the opportunity to give people a second chance. And I think that that's very important. And as lieutenant governor, you can kind of craft that role just like how the vice president can craft his or her role. If there are some issues that are really pressing, then you can really work on those issues. And education, criminal justice, job creation, and environmental justice, for me, are all encompassing. And those are areas where I've currently been working as a councilwoman and shall continue the work as lieutenant governor.
Sure. So you mentioned the backlog of pardons. How extensive is that backlog?
Some people said they have been waiting for a year to 2 years in order to even have their case seen or heard. And so getting in there, I am a worker bee. So one thing that we can do is start moving that backlog and getting people to the forefront and making sure that we're taking care of business.
You've advocated for changes to the amount of campaign funding that one should be able to raise. What do you think the caps should be, and how would you enforce that?
To be quite honest, I feel like people raise an exorbitant amount of money for campaigns. And if people can raise that kind of money, then why do we have homeless veterans? Why do we have children in need in this country? Children are going to school without their proper uniforms. Children actually don't have a place to call home. Right now, there are 20 children in Lewis who are homeless and who are currently going to school. So if people can raise that kind of money for a campaign, why not put those efforts into shifting the atmosphere throughout our state from Wilmington all the way down to Selbyville and making sure that we provide the needs for the individuals? You don't even make that much money as the lieutenant governor. So why is there a need to have $250,000, $300,000, $400,000, or $500,000 when shoe leather doesn't cost you a thing except just buying a new pair of shoes? It's nothing like interacting with the people, knocking on the doors, and hearing the needs of the constituents. Now, granted, you may not be able to hit every single person, but it is important to just get out and do the work. And I feel like there's so much money being wasted in the political arena that we could be using to save lives. What would be the cap? I guess it's contingent upon what the position is. When I ran for city council, I probably had maybe $2,000 or $3,000, if that, and that's a stretch. When I ran for the state senate, I had $10,000. And when I ran for city council, I won. And when I ran for state senate, 37 is my new favorite number. I was defeated by 37 votes. So when you look at it holistically, and the person I ran against had $100,000. So this really shouldn't be about money. It really should be about the fortitude of the individual and the desire to really want to make change. And part of making that change is taking money out of politics, the exorbitant amount of money out of politics. Now, we know it takes money to drive up and down the state to pay the tolls. We know it takes money to buy signs. We know it takes money if you're going to have billboards and create a presence. But outside of that, what else are you doing with the money? What else? I can't figure out why people need that amount of money to run.
You also mentioned raising the minimum wage. What do you think the minimum wage should be in Delaware, and how would you work to raise it?
I've worked diligently to try to raise the minimum wage, but I'd like to say that I don't work in a box. I work with others. So we collectively, coalitions with which I've been working, have been working to raise the minimum wage. And I do believe that the minimum wage should be a livable wage. I own a film production company, Swap Productions LLC, and I do pay my workers what they are worth, beyond what they're worth when I have an opportunity to do so, when we have a larger budget. But I do believe that the minimum wage should be $15 an hour. That way, we don't have a working poor anymore.
Criminal justice is obviously an important issue to you. How would you ensure that issues related to crime, poverty, and the ramification of these issues are dealt with not only in Wilmington, but in other Delaware cities and counties?
When people think about crime, they think about Wilmington, but no one's thinking about the fact that Dover has tripled its number of homicides in the last year. No one's thinking about that there actually have been shootings in Bridgeville and in Selbyville this year. So we really need to look at crime holistically throughout the state. And how do you do that? You create jobs. Job creation is the best solution for crime. And we have too many elected officials who are playing games with the lives of others and have opportunities to create jobs, but they're blocking it. Right now, the Port of Wilmington is a great example. We have an opportunity to create tens of thousands of jobs with the Port of Wilmington, and it's a political struggle just to get the environmental impact study, which is $500,000, to ensure that we can actually build. The city gave $150,000, the county gave $150,000. We're still waiting on the state to give $200,000 for a $500,000 study. So when we think about things holistically, I think people need to get out of their own way, and people need to start really looking at what needs to be done, because as the politicians are having these petty arguments, people are still dying in the streets. And we could be creating so many opportunities if people would just stop being egotistical and being angry and just see the needs of the people and realize who elected you, the people, and they elected you to serve. They didn't elect you for your own self-aggrandizement. They elected you to serve them and to do it well.
How have your films and your other experience in city council informed your knowledge of issues that you think are important to this role?
My art, which of course imitates life, my art actually helped transform me and pushed me into this arena. I did a film entitled Justice for All, the documentary, and that was a 3-year comprehensive study of juvenile justice in America and overseas. So we traveled to over 50 different cities in the U.S. and traveled abroad, comparing and contrasting juvenile justice systems. And when we realized, again, I say we, my crew and I, when we realized that juvenile justice a lot of times deals with socioeconomics in many instances, because the poor Caucasian child is going to get the same punishment as the poor Hispanic or African American child, but the affluent African American child in most cases will get the same punishment as the affluent Caucasian child. So really, it's all about resources. And in doing that film, what I realized is, we did the film, it was screened before the Congressional Black Caucus in 2008, and some of the federal laws were changed regarding juvenile justice in 2007. In 2008, some of the laws changed regarding juvenile justice. So realizing that art can really transform lives, and then doing a film entitled SOS Square, Saving Our Sisters, Sharing Our Stories. And that was a film chronicling the lives of women in Sussex County. And the Susan G. Komen Foundation, as well as the Tunnel Cancer Center downstate, wanted to find out why women of color were dying at alarming rates, but Caucasian women were diagnosed far more often with breast cancer. And what we found is it had a lot to do with transportation. Doctors were diagnosing people with fibrocystic disease and misdiagnosing them, and through the process of the misdiagnosis, the cancer was metastasizing within the women of color. So some of that has actually changed. The state has looked at changing health care and how health care is rendered in Sussex County, and then making sure that people can get back and forth to their doctor's appointments. So in seeing that you can use your art to make changes in life, that's kind of what brought me over to this arena. Of course, having some other influences as well, but that was one of the main things.
And you mentioned that the laws changed in 2008. How did they change, and how do you think those laws still need to be changed?
Well, the federal government had not changed any laws regarding juvenile justice since 1974. And the federal government really had to look at things holistically, because this was a country where we were giving children juvenile life. And so Pennsylvania had 27 children serving juvenile life. And so in most cases, when we talk about juvenile life, you're supposed to get out by the time you're 21. But as a juvenile, these children were given life sentences, life without the possibility of parole. I can't imagine being 14, 15, 16 years old, committing a crime and having to serve the rest of my life for something that I did at 16. It's a little different when I'm an adult and I commit the crime, but my frontal lobes haven't even developed properly. Psychologically, I'm not where I would be if I'm 27 and commit that same crime. So the federal government really started looking at things holistically and looking at the punishment. And so we no longer have juvenile life in this country.
How in Delaware specifically has that legislation changed?
Delaware really had done a good job of not giving people life without the possibility of parole. What Delaware did is we would take our juveniles and try them as adults. And so if you're tried as an adult, then you can get an adult sentence. So that's what we were doing. And that's something that we really need to take a look at that and restructure that, because there are certain crimes that we don't try people as adults, and then other crimes where we do. Now we need to look at the equity in that, who's being tried and who's allowed to go home. So we really need to re-examine our judicial system.
Kind of on that same note, your campaign page mentions the Ban the Box initiative. Can you talk a little about some of these national advocacy efforts and how your views align with their efforts?
Absolutely. Ban the Box should have happened a long time ago, but we're grateful that it has happened here in our city, and the city of Wilmington, the county, Newcastle County, as well as the state of Delaware. That was a box where if a felon had committed a crime, he or she would have to check the box that they are indeed a felon. Now, the problem with that is, if I'm looking at an application and I'm in personnel, I may have preconceived notions about someone who may have had to serve some time. So that person doesn't even get an opportunity for an interview. So now the box is no longer on the application. People are getting opportunities not only for interviews, but to go into the job and talk about their experiences and how they can help others and how they can make a difference.
You've also called for an end to the school to jail pipeline and spoken about HB 85's role in contributing to the schoolhouse to jailhouse. How is this legislation contributing to the problem, and what would you do to help change it?
HB 85, House Bill 85, has contributed to the disproportionate number of children of color being in the judicial system. And as I stated a little earlier, if, in fact, there's a situation in a school, the state has taken a lot of the power away from the building supervisors. In many cases, there are children who are traumatized all throughout the state, from Claymont all the way down to Delmar. And if my father's involved in some illegal activity and I'm a student and I have to go to school the next day and the police came into my house doing their job, and I go to school the next day, the chances are I'm traumatized, especially if I'm in fourth grade all the way up to 12th grade. So I may need some mental health counseling. Instead of giving the child what he or she needs as far as a wellness center and treatment, the children are being punished for the behaviors of those around them. And children will act out, because negative attention is better than no attention at all. So it ultimately has led to a lot of the children who are traumatized in their own communities end up in the juvenile justice system, and no one's dealing with the mental health side of the trauma that they're experiencing every day in their communities. I'll give you a perfect example. While out knocking doors, I heard 8 gunshots. I was outside with two 12-year-olds, and the one 12-year-old said, and it was just so matter-of-factly, "Oh, Miss Sherry, you'll be fine. That was about two or three blocks over." It was almost like it's every day. We have to be mindful that we have children all throughout the state who are living in war zones. And when our military personnel come home, we are supposed to make sure that they get treated for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So often, our children are suffering from that same disorder, yet nobody's dealing with it. And what ultimately happens, they end up in the judicial system, the juvenile justice system. That's why HB 85 needs to be abolished, or we need to really look at it and give more autonomy to the building supervisors who know that these things have taken place in the community the night before and can assess the situation.
House Bill 85, it's allowing children who might be acting out of school to be charged right in the school or outside of the school.
HB 85 grants the opportunity for the child to, and it shouldn't be an opportunity, but the child ultimately ends up in the justice system for a situation in school. A minor schoolyard fight could land a child in the judicial system, and the child could ultimately end up with a felony. And in this country, if you have a felony, you are not eligible for financial aid, and you cannot go into the military. So what do you do? How do you better your life? You turn to the streets, or you do whatever you feel you need to do to survive.
Sure. And on that same note of the need for trauma-informed care in schools, how would you work to ensure that these services are made available?
Working with the Colonial School District, I think they have one of the better models, and I say that because Dr. Blakely has done an excellent job. He opened the first wellness center in an elementary school here in the state of Delaware. And that's important because he recognizes that, and his staff recognize that, the children from first grade through fifth grade are experiencing trauma. By the time we get them in sixth grade, they may have experienced so much over the past 5 years from the first through the fifth grade that they just feel like they're hopeless. And so if we can get the wraparound services for the children where we can make them whole, a lot of times we can't change their home environment because where they live is where they live. And a lot of the children will go, and they will not want to go into foster care. And if they have another relative who can take them, that's different. But they don't want to go into an environment that's unfamiliar. They'd rather stay in that negative environment because they know what they can expect and what they will expect. However, they still need wraparound services to help them deal with the holistic situation that they're currently experiencing. And not only through the wellness center can we help our children, but the wellness center can also, the word says, and a child will lead them. The children can ultimately get the parents to understand, "I'm not putting you down, mommy or daddy, but we need to make some changes in our household. Why don't you come to this place where I go during the school day for an hour or so, and maybe they can help you too." And before you know it, now we've shifted the atmosphere by helping the child, and the child helps the parent. And granted, it should be the parent helping the child, we know that, but things are out of order in many communities all over the state, not just in one part of the state. So we have to address these issues and concerns. Many people don't know that Sussex County has the highest level of poverty, children in poverty going to school. Those are issues that we definitely have to address. And when you are poor and you're trying to go to school, you're going to school hungry. You're going to school, you may not have the proper clothing. Or if you do, your clothes may not be clean because your mother or father may not have been able to afford to go to the laundromat. We need people in office who aren't all privileged, who get the struggles of the everyday citizen, so that we can dig deep, put our fingernails in the dirt, and come up and make gold out of the dirt that we're given.
Does Colonial have the services available for family counseling as well as just the kids?
What happens a lot of times in that particular district, Colonial does a phenomenal job of, like for instance, McCullough School. You have Mrs. Hughes who does a fabulous job. Mrs. Hughes Gross does a great job of having parent night, and she'll have a mother-daughter tea. And that's an opportunity for mothers to just reconnect with their daughters without, you don't have a whole lot of activities going on at the time. No one's using their cell phone. And the leadership over at McCullough School, the principal, the teachers, I was so pleased to be there. They had painting with a purpose. They had Zumba. They had hula hoops. And it was just fun for the parents to just be there with their children in that space without worrying about answering a cell phone, email, and just being present in the moment. And Kelowna does a really good job of father, son, mother, daughter. And I think that's a model that we could take throughout the state and really mimic that. I believe Red Clay does some has some dynamics like that, but I know for sure Colonial, because I've been engaged with them and helped them with those nights.
Also, in terms of education, you mentioned the need to create a funding system for schools based on needs so that resources are distributed accordingly. And how would you go about starting this process?
Schools with children from high poverty communities have the greatest needs. And as we just finished discussing, we do need wellness centers in our school. Now, how are we going to pay for it? Well, we waste $42 million on keeping people on death row. We have 14 men currently on death row. It costs up to $3 million to house them annually. That's $42 million that we're wasting on state-sanctioned murder. But thank goodness for the Delaware Supreme Court, who on August the 2nd ruled the death penalty unconstitutional. And they looked at the Constitution and said the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, is what the death penalty is. So that's $42 million that we don't have to spend on state-sanctioned murder, and we can put it on the front end in our educational system and really start making those necessary changes so that the high-poverty schools get the resources that they need. Every school district should be able to operate like the Cape Henlopen School District or the Brandywine School District, where you have the committed teachers. And I'm not saying teachers aren't committed in any of the low poverty schools, so I don't want that to be misunderstood. But what I'm saying is Brandywine and Cape Henlopen School Districts have the resources necessary to do what needs to be done to help their students. And those are models that need to be taken all throughout the state so that we can ensure, even if a child is from a high poverty community, that child has an opportunity to still go to college or go into the military or go straight into the workforce if that's what he or she desires, but they're ready.
You mentioned cutting the dollars that are used towards those on death row from the budget. Are there other areas that you feel like there is waste in the budget, and what are those, and how would you cut those areas?
There's a lot of waste, and I'll tell you why. Because the state always puts together a task force. So there's a task force to address racism at the University of Delaware. I attended the University of Delaware. I had a great experience while I was there, and I stood on the shoulders of those who went before me, and I was very grateful for those who opened the door so that I could attend University of Delaware. But understand this, we do not need a task force to tell us what we already know. You don't need a task force to tell you what you already know. We need a task force to tell us that there's high poverty schools. No, you don't. You already know that there's high poverty schools. Let's start dealing with the solutions. And each time there's a task force, there's always $250,000 or $300,000 or $500,000 set aside for the task force. Okay. Let's stop it, and let's put the money where it needs to go instead of putting money into these task force that run the state. So it cost us millions of dollars to have these task force. Take that money away and put it to good use.
Anything else in terms of the budget that you'd like to add?
I think that we need to really look at where we're wasting money, and then we also need to look at where we can take care of our people. We have, and I read a document, and it said something about human capital. And if you're looking at human beings as human capital and not as people or citizens or our constituents, then it's very easy to cut budgets dealing with quote-unquote human capital. But when we know we're dealing with a heart, body, soul of an individual, and we're dealing with individuals who are raising families, and we're not referring to them as such, we call them people, then that makes it a little harder to cut their positions and to cut their pay. Now, we can look at different ways that we can save money in this state, but the one thing we should not be doing, for instance, look at our correction officers, look at our teachers, look at EMS, fire, and police. We're asking them to do so much more with so little. those are the professions where they should be making the money that basketball players are making and football players and baseball players and soccer and hockey players. But our priorities are not congruent with what we say we desire for our families. We have to start putting our money where our mouth is, or shut our mouths.
Any other major areas or issues of importance to you, or anything, any other specific plans you'd like to address?
I think we also need to look at the fact that manufactured housing is major here in this state, and especially downstate. And in doing research and making environmental justice part of my platform, one of the things that I discovered is people who live downstate who live in manufactured housing have too much lead and or copper in their water. That is unconscionable. It should be unconstitutional, and actually it's criminal. And we don't want a Flint, Michigan here in Delaware in any part of our state. The upper parts of our state, we do have fairly clean water. Wilmington is 4.04, and the EPA sets that PPB, parts per billion, at 15. Dover, 4.04 as well. But as we start to get a little lower in the state and we deal with manufactured housing, it's just unconscionable what's happening in those communities. So I'll be the lieutenant governor for all people, not just for a certain set. So often we've had people in office and they've only served a certain set of people. They've only served the interests of, well, if I'm Irish, I'm only going to deal with the Irish or the Polish or the Italian. I'll be the lieutenant governor as an African American for all people, because I know what it feels like when people don't have your back.
What do you think sets you apart from the other candidates?
I think we're all great candidates, and I think we all have a heart for the people. But I believe that service has to be above self, and I believe that we have to ensure that we're doing this for the right reasons. This cannot be about power, privilege, and prestige. It has to be about the people, and it can't be about elevating one's career. It has to be about doing the work for the people. And some people will say, well, you know, it's a stepping stone. No, it isn't. Wherever you have been placed at that moment, whether you are the custodian at the school, you are touching the lives of those children that you clean those floors every day. And those floors are clean such that the children don't have to worry about pests in their schools. My job as lieutenant governor is to work closely with the governor, work with the General Assembly, and I'd be the lieutenant governor who works very closely with the community. I am boots on the ground. I'm a byproduct of a teacher and a military man, so I know what it's like I've seen infantry in my own home, and I have to say, that's the thing. I love the work, and I don't shy away from work. I don't shy away from a good fight, not fist fight. I'm talking about a fight that's going to serve the people, a social justice fight. So the one thing that you don't have to worry about is I don't flip-flop either. My yes is yes and my no is no. And I'll listen. I'll listen before I formulate my yes or my no so that I can get all the facts. But the one thing I won't do is say, oh, I'm for it, but yet I'm against it. And I'm not for or against something based off who has given money to my campaign, because I don't take special interest money. So I'm beholden to the people who are funding my campaign. And That's the people of the state of Delaware, and people from Pennsylvania, Ohio, wherever they saw information about my campaign online and decided to make a contribution. So I don't have those affiliations where I'm beholden to a certain organization. I'm beholden to the people who put me in office.
What are your ultimate career goals, even beyond a lieutenant governor?
I can honestly tell you right now, I love being a city councilwoman. I aspire to be lieutenant governor so that I can be in a position where I can help even more people. And I'm a filmmaker by trade, so using my art to make a difference in society and to help change public policy, that's where I am in this journey. And however I can be of service to God's people, that's what I desire to do.